Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's binary episode of the Day Zero podcast. I'm Spectre, with me is Z. Today, we have a Linux-heavy episode, contrary to last week. But again, we also have another CPU bug, so we're going to lead off with that. This is coming out of Tavis Ormandy, formerly of Project Zero. And yeah, this might be a more significant CPU bug than the last one we covered. So I'll let Z get into it.
Might be, although key thing with this one is there's a lot of questions that are kind of up in the air as to what you can actually do with it versus what's theoretically possible with it. The main question is over how much control you're really able to exert over what you do with this. But it definitely does. It's definitely a pretty crazy bug. Although I actually want to bring up a really quick thing. You just mentioned Tavis Ormandy, formerly of Project Zero. Did he leave? Because I remember, I think it was Ned Williamson left. I guess it's been a little while now, but I didn't realize Tavis did also.
Yeah, no, I think he left earlier this year.
Okay, I just didn't notice that. Anyway, on for the actual issue here. Unfortunately, we don't really have a lot of details over what the exact problem is. They do talk a little bit about how they were trying to discover things. They talk a bit about this verification framework that they did, which sounds like they're basically just running it across like two CPUs and are running the same set of instructions and seeing if the outputs differ. If they do, you know, you've got some sort of issue there. And what they ended up noticing was that this instruction here, the, I can highlight it, rex.rxb rep mov sb, which is a nice long x86 and, well, x86 64, but whatever, instruction. And the important thing with the bug seems to be this rex kind of prefix being used. Again, they don't really know exactly why this is happening, but using that rex with the rep instruction there, rep, if you're unfamiliar, is basically just like a repeat and uses a couple of the registers to determine how far or how many times it's going to repeat. That's the thing there. And then the rex is it's a prefix for the command, and I'm more or less unfamiliar. Like, I've never used this myself. We're talking about a little bit pre-show, but the idea is simply, or how they put it in here, is it increases the available space for encoding operands. So if you want to hit registers that maybe you wouldn't normally be able to use, you can use this prefix in order to expand the space that you've got, like add some extra bits in order to encode those registers. They do talk about here with this little graphics, you know, the rex prefix can lend the next instruction extra bits to use for operands, so we can encode all 16 possible general purpose registers. So fair enough. I've never used it. Maybe the compiler has with something I've written, but it's not exactly part of my assembly vocabulary or whatever. So I do have a little bit of unfamiliarity there. But that instruction, nonetheless, does something weird. And I guess one other thing, kind of with how the CPUs work, I feel like a lot of us have kind of now been exposed to the idea that there is microcode that's actually implementing a lot of the instructions that we see. So you have kind of the front end, that's your assembly, comes in, gets CPUs going to fetch those instructions, decode them, and generate the microcode for the back end to actually execute. And the back end will actually execute these instructions, potentially out of order, and has kind of a reorder buffer to store and organize those results. And what they speculate is happening with this bug is that using the prefix will result in a miscalculation, or the front end miscalculating the size of that MOV instruction, meaning that's going to basically misread out of the reorder buffer. And that's going to create the kind of the situation where it's associating incorrect addresses with the results. And the CPU in that case can enter a confused state that causes the instruction pointer to be miscalculated. They do call out here that they don't know what all is possible with this. They can observe, you know, having the miscalculated instruction pointer, which is a pretty serious bug to have the instruction pointer go somewhere it shouldn't, especially when this is happening at the CPU level.
So yeah, they mentioned some of the things that happen, like sometimes you'll have unconditional branches that just get skipped, or you'll have like branching but not branching to the correct target. So sort of the same behaviors that you would observe if you're doing like fault injection. This sort of gives you a similar primitive to what fault injection would give you, but you're doing it through software, which is pretty cool, but also pretty impactful.
Yeah, it has potentially a massive impact if you're able to execute like a good level of control over that corruption. But this one of the last paragraphs they have here is, however, we simply don't know if we can control the corruption precisely enough to achieve privilege escalation. I suspect it is possible, but we don't have any way to debug the micro-operation execution, which is fair. Like, that is not an area that they just hand out, like, everybody gets access to a debugger for. I don't even know what they have in terms of just internal tooling or whatever. I imagine there's some level of debuggability, but it's basically just a black box to anybody outside of the actual manufacturer. But still, it seems like a really cool bug. Really interesting to see it happen at the CPU level and this sort of impact. It's not like the, like a cache issue or something like that. It's, bad instructions. It's just a really weird bug, so I at least wanted to bring it up here.
Yeah. I do want to quickly mention, I think you left this part out, but part of why this is an issue is that rex prefix, it's like you said, it's used for encoding like additional operands, but since like the movesb instruction doesn't take any operands, it's redundant. And they mentioned near the beginning that x86 is kind of weird and that it's laid back. Like, you can pass prefixes on instructions, and if they're not relevant or unused, it'll just kind of silently ignore them. It won't blow up on you or anything like that. It is considered legal, so to speak. But it seems in this specific case, at least, something that's usually like a no operation where it's just ignored is what's throwing off that calculation. So it's really strange that it happens with like this one opcode, and it makes me wonder if maybe it can happen with others and it just hasn't really been discovered yet. Or maybe with different prefixes or whatever. I think the good news with this is this should be fixable with a microcode update, so it's maybe not as big of a CPU issue in terms of like fixing it. When you're getting into microcode territory, it is a lot more obscure.
Perhaps fixable with a microcode update, although we don't really know it is the microcode.
That is my speculation. Like, I think it's likely it is, but yeah, I don't want to say for sure.
Like, it is very possible that it is actually just a hardware issue. Like, when you do this, like we talked about the other hardware bug not super long ago, where the speculation there was just kind of entering that bad state. Could maybe be something like that here too, but yeah, we just don't know. It's still
Said that I was speculating. They literally say in the solution, Intel had published updated microcode for affected processors. There we go. Somehow I missed that the first time around.
Fair enough. So they were able to update the microcode, and definitely not hardware then. Or, they're at least mitigating it from that.
Yeah. And just like the other, this bug has some similarities with the other one. One of them is their POC, and the ultimate way they abuse this is they trigger a memory check. So if you just try to trigger this bug a few times on a single core, something may or may not happen. The way they increase their likelihood of hitting it is they get multiple cores to execute it and then get a memory check triggered. So the reliability of hitting it is a little bit questionable. But then also, something they call out, and which was also I brought up in the other bug that we covered, was this can be hittable from a guest VM. Which can be pretty significant in like cloud environments. So it does have, like, if you are able to leverage the privilege escalation aspect of it, it could be, impactful for virtualization scenarios.
Yeah. I mean, there's a clear potential for impact with this bug. Like they say, it kind of comes down to what level of control they really have over everything. And that's still something to be explored and studied a bit.
Yeah.
And definitely hard to do for the reasons I was talking about earlier, like the debugability of this issue. Like, you don't have access to have like a nice debugger set up in here. Like, you don't have the usual sort of tooling that you would expect to debug a corruption.
You have no introspection. Yeah. So, yeah, we may see more come out of Reptar in the future, but yeah, the impact isn't super clear as of yet.
Yeah, all right, so we'll get into with the author. Like, they do mention that they speculate that it is probably possible to do it, just they lack kind of the experience and study or time studying it to figure it all out. But I would agree that it feels like something that's probably workable.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I put it in sort of the similar bucket as fault injection, where for people who don't know what I'm talking about there, like, fault injection is when you mess with the CPU to cause it to do some kind of unpredictable behavior, like you disrupt the power input going to it or bombard it with electromagnetic pulses or something like that. The difference there, though, is with fault injection, you have a lot more control over the timing and you can keep trying it over and over again with some kind of setup. Whereas with this, you don't have as much control on the timing or when it happens. You kind of just have to hope that it happens, but I'm sure there's at least some scenarios that it could be leveraged. So, all right, but yeah, we can get into some of our Linux issues. So, yeah, up first, we have a slide presentation, one-shot triple kill, pwning all three Google kernel CTF instances with a single one-day Linux phone, and I'll let Z get into this one.
Yeah, and I kind of hate working off of the slides here, but you can kind of see the bottom here. This was a Power of Community presentation, so we're not going to be getting any visual or any actual talk with this. Slides are about all we're going to get unless they do a better write-up of this. But as far as I can tell, they've not put that out. So first off, a little clarification. As they mentioned here at the top, pwning all three kernel CTF instances. That's because with the Google's kernel CTF, what they're doing, we've talked about it a handful of times, more generically is just being like a platform that focuses more on the exploitation side. So you can report one-day vulnerabilities because the focus is on actually exploiting them in on what is presumably a recently updated machine in one case. So they have kind of three setups that you can try to attack and capture the flag on. One of those being the latest kind of stable long or LTS edition of the Linux kernel. That's updating, you know, every like couple weeks, every month or so. And that's exactly what it sounds like, just the latest long-term stable version. The other version is a mitigation version. It's not as upgraded. However, it has kind of experimental mitigations turned on. And the other version is their container optimized kernel configuration. That's what they're using on like the cloud and like GKE when they offer Kubernetes and stuff. That's what they're offering there. So being able to basically attack the Google Cloud is the other scenario. So they have three scenarios and they wrote their they use their one vulnerability and two exploits to exploit all three of those, basically. So getting into the vulnerability, seems like the vulnerability was effectively just a coding issue or misunderstanding. Because if you take a look at this, I'm just going to jump right into this code, but it's within netfilter stuff, within a netfilter batch or transaction, so you can give kind of multiple things to be done during that. They all get run. You can create a kind of new set of rules or netfilter expressions. So you create the new set, and in an error case, if an error happens while adding one of the new rules, it ultimately ends up falling into this deactivate set function, which takes a look at what phase the system is currently in. So, like, they have the transaction prepare phase, but they also have or for what matters here, the other case is the NFT transaction release phase. So when they fall into this error case, they end up just basically setting the phase to be that transaction release phase. Although the error is happening fairly early on, during a transaction, this can actually be in the prepare phase, and they basically just have the wrong phase being forced in here. And so the difference ends up being when it uses the release phase, it'll do the same reference count decrement, and then it will go to unbind the set as it falls through into the default case. Whereas if you're in the prepare phase, it's not going to try and unbind the set. You can still do whatever using the set. It's not going to do anything there. And so that difference ultimately ends up leading to a use after free scenario where if you have one transaction, you create your new set, you add a new rule to it, and during adding that rule, it falls into this error case. You hit that error case, it ends up unbinding the set, it ends up freeing the set, and then when you go and add another rule still inside of that same transaction, so it still has a reference to the set, it's now referencing a freed object, and so you end up with that use after free. In the patch, they kind of have here on slide 16 is literally just replacing the call to NFT rule or NF tables rule release. And that function called these next two functions. So they kind of did a little bit of refactoring here. What this really comes down to is they just changed that phase that's being used into a transaction prepare instead of the transaction release that we talked about. So simple patch. That's why I believe at its core, like, that's just the root issue, just a developer misunderstanding of the code.
And a very fair one at that, because when I was first reading through this, I was like, okay, you're in an error path, like, calling a release routine, because that's another thing. There was a bit of indirection here, because the patch, you can see they originally called this NF tables rule release, which then inside of that would use the netfilter tables trans release flag. So when you're looking at the code and you're just like, okay, the like go-to is called error release rule, then call rule release, like it makes sense, it's intuitive. But there's more nuances there, and again, they were kind of hidden behind that extra call. So
yeah, like it was
a very understandable one.
Yeah, like I don't think the NF tables rule release function is doing it wrong, because you know it's explicitly trying to release. Like I don't think it's actually wrong, and that's why in doing this patch, they no longer call that function. They didn't get rid of the function because it still has its use. They just basically replace the same function, which is just two lines. With the same thing, just different phase. So the author of this particular thing, I had kind of a thought I was just working through about why it might have been, but I'm not actually going to get into it, just explaining my pause there. It does feel pretty understandable to try and just reuse the function, because that's kind of in your head what you're doing. I think it's fair. It would be hard even to spot this as you're just reading through the code without really stepping through what everything means and what it does. You may not notice that the difference really matters.
Yeah, it's a pretty subtle issue.
Yeah, or at least I'd say so looking at it from here. I haven't done a lot of auditing in NF tables, but yeah, it's a fairly complex subsystem, has a lot going on. Fair enough. So, I've just pulled up kind of the state for at least getting a use after free, and it's basically what I said. You start the batch, or transaction, create your new set, trigger the error condition, so freeze, add a rule using that new set, using the now freed set. Out of chat, XCD80S, there's paper on it. As far as I can tell, we've only got these slides. There was a presentation given at Power of Community. However,
yeah,
they don't put
this came at a Power of Community. Yeah, they don't really put out resources. We're actually kind of lucky we got slides for this. A fair amount of like POC talks don't even the slides aren't even released. So
yeah, so unfortunately, as far as I've seen, we don't have anything kind of more detailed. it is possible that they will put out a blog or they will put out a paper. It has happened, but this is all we've got right now. Now, while this is a use after free bug, the way they actually exploit this was rather than trying to race, it's pretty small. I want to say it's pretty small because you're needing to do it inside of the same transaction. That said, you know, adding a bunch of rules, you could probably open the window up a bit on there. Nonetheless, and I'm saying probably a game because of my own unfamiliarity, but they decided not to. They did kind of raise the idea that they could race these different areas and try and reclaim the transaction, do something with that. But instead, what they went for was trying to do a double free, which was basically just by, you know, you go create the new set. In theory, you would get the double free just by... you free the set and then you end the batch and it's going to free again. Once the transactions ends, it, you know, gets freed. However, you do have in the slub allocator within the Linux kernel a fairly naive double free detection. I mean, a number of allocators do it. Basically, when you free something, it just looks and makes sure you're not freeing the same item twice in a row. So as long as you can get something else freed in between, you're able to get around it. Stops a few cases, not a ton, but it is a fair, like, really quick sanity check to perform.
I like to call that strategy interleave double freeing. You're still getting enough. The double free, you're just interleaving something else with it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's kind of what they go at here, and that's why this chain is a little bit non-obvious at first, but they create two, so in their one transaction again, this time they're creating two sets, add a rule to the first set, causing the free, add a rule to the second set, causing a free, they're different, end the batch, and you get the original set freed at that point, so you have two frees that are usable. And then from there, with a double free, you end up with a memory overlay sort of primitive where you can have basically allocated by one thing and allocated by some other object type, and they're both pointing to the same memory, but they're parsing that same memory in different ways. You know, with use after free, you've got like the same sort of primitive where you have kind of the thing that's using the object after it's been free, and you reallocate it with something else that has a different view of that same memory. So two vulnerabilities in my mind are really just in the sense of they're overlaying or they're looking at the same memory, but with the double free, they can basically load these up as any objects they want, any objects they want within like the same cache, and there's some other restrictions on there, but any object that they can reclaim it with, they can use it. They end up going through the message technique, which I feel like we've talked about a number of times, filling up their chain using the message, MSG object. What they end up targeting is basically one of these objects. They can be dynamically sized, so you can have just a arbitrary sized piece of user controlled data following it. So effectively all they'll do is they'll increase the text size value and creating an overread. So they get a relative read primitive so they could read out into other piece of data. They use that to leak a pointer into the kmalloc cg 1k cache. Doesn't really matter a ton, but they're aiming to then go and corrupt this pipe buffer that has an ops pointer in it. They're going to aim to corrupt that ops structure. Fairly standard thing. It has a bunch of function pointers in there, so once they read it, they break kernel ASLR, and then they can start writing their own pointers in there, going for a kernel ROP strategy. Which, fair enough, I think a lot of exploits we talk about go the data route, but that, I think, is mostly because we're looking at... we often talk about the Android and the Android use cases, whereas on Linux, you don't have, like... Or you don't necessarily have, like, CFI turned on and things like that, so it becomes a bit easier.
Not very common, at least.
Yeah, well, at the very least, it becomes easier to go this route where they go for a ROP chain. I was also a little bit surprised. So their container only version use a slightly different technique. They use this user key payload struct, and then using that, or having the original NFT set reclaimed by that, they were basically able to read in and leak some of the pointers here, so gain access to an op structure. So they were able to leak the kernel ASLR. They were able to leak a pointer into the KMalloc1k cache through one of the other fields. Basically, just read that and got all of the information that they actually needed. Free that object, reclaim it again with new data to now corrupt the NFT set. And again, from there, they went, you know, they can corrupt the ops again. So they went for a ROP. They did something a little bit different, which I feel like I don't see super often on Linux, especially. They went for a ROP, but then they used the ROP to call the set memory X, or create or set the memory as executable. And just put use like kernel shell code in order to go after this. So the ROP was just the presumably just like the one function and the arguments for it in order to call into shell code, which, you know, fair enough, it works. I just feel like I don't see shell code being used like that super often. Still is kind of common with well, I guess that's more Windows user land, not kernel side. But yeah, and using those techniques, they went to target the mitigation instance and have this comic here, you know, mitigation asking, like, should they use the mitigation server? Not a chance. And their exploits just work. And ultimately, it comes down to the fact that the mitigations that they have turned on ultimately aren't doing a lot to stop this particular exploit. They call out the three mitigations that get introduced on there as being the slab virtual, and that is just to prevent cross cache attacks. Maybe we'll talk about that in one of the later topics a bit, but it's a technique that is sometimes used to basically turn your use app free in one cache to a use app free in another cache. It does some, or works a little bit against that, but they don't even use it here. Similarly, the KMalloc split var size, that just creates like the dynamically sized objects versus statically sized going different caches. They only use the dynamically sized stuff in their techniques. So again, not an issue. And then the last one was the free list, which had an interesting
free list hardening.
Yeah, sorry, free list hardening. Config slap free list hard, which did have kind of an interesting case, because what that does, it kind of creates a bid mask over all of the free addresses need to match this bid mask, where the idea is, or one of the attacks that's meant to stop, is kind of crafting like an arbitrary pointer to put in the free list to get it used. This way it has to actually be inside of there, it has to be aligned properly and all of that. However, it only applies when the free list address actually kind of gets checked and put into the list kind of properly, like something else needs to use it. So in their exploit, they end up using, they basically end up freeing the invalid address and reusing it immediately. So it's only sitting at the head of the free list and never needs to go through this check, which I thought was a fun aspect to this, just kind of by chance getting around this mitigation. I didn't really talk about the case where they use that, but they did use kind of that corrupted free entry in one of their attacks. But yeah, on a whole, like, I did have trouble actually following through a lot of these slides, and I think that really just comes down to the fact that these are slides and not like a well thought through presentation. Like, we don't have all the other context of everything that was said, but still kind of fun exploit to read through, and they do go deeper, I think, into their exploit than some places would, you know, talking about what their thought was on how they're doing their ROP chain and such. I know sometimes we just gloss right over the ROP chain aspect, so
it's tricky to cover exploit implementation stuff in a talk, because you're pretty time constrained and you don't want to, you know, lose the audience if they're not familiar with some of the background. So you don't get to see it super often, but it is here. But as you said, where you're missing the context of what's being said and whatnot, it can be a bit tricky to follow, which is why I kind of hope there is a blog post that comes at some point. But even without it, especially because they're using the GNOME technique of like message objects, you can still follow along fairly easily.
Yeah, it's like if you're willing to do the extra Googling, like message is in some unknown technique or something, like you can read up on a lot of this and a lot of it like does make sense. I would just love to kind of have I would love to see the talk, honestly.
Yeah, one day I'd like to go to the Power community just because there's a lot of talks that are really cool that happen at it, but they don't, you know, if you didn't go there, you're not going to see them. So.
Yeah, and PAX's a Korean conference, right?
I think it's in South Korea, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can't imagine anybody's really going to a North Korean conference.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah. I guess that's kind of implied.
Yeah.
So, yeah, with that said, though, we can get into our next Linux bug. So, it's funny when you keep in context of KCTF, because IOU ring bugs used to be aplenty in KCTF, and then Google was like, okay, we're not dealing with this anymore. So IOU ring was like cut out of the KCTF containers. So where people moved was the netfilter stuff. So we're kind of going backward here. So yeah, this is a Linux kernel exploit abusing a bug in none other than IOU ring, which, because it was such a buggy mess, was stripped out of the KCTF and Kubernetes containers. Because at one point, literally every bug that was being paid out for some time was an IOU ring bug. So we were made aware of this post from the author in our Discord, Anatomical, and it writes up a bug that was discovered by Tobias Hall. So for those not familiar with IOU ring, it's basically a Linux API implemented through system calls that allows for asynchronous IO through shared memory. So you have a submission and a completion queue ring, which the user space can write into the submission queue. You can signal the kernel through the IOU ring enter syscall to process those entries, and then the kernel will write into the completion queue, which the user space can then read, and that's how the communication works. It also has various other features and functionality. The one that's relevant here is fixed buffers. So I think we've talked about fixed buffers a couple times because they've been relevant for other vulnerabilities as well. But the idea there is you can basically register buffers that have their pages pinned so that they're not paged out and they stay mapped in memory for long-term use. And that's a performance thing, because when you're trying to access memory and it has to be paged in, you have to wait for that to happen, and it's just not something you want to deal with if you're doing a lot of IO heavy work. So the sort of issue, though, is when they're dealing with registering these buffers, there's a bit of logic that needs to be implemented in the kernel, because paging is somewhat complicated, and you're basically letting the user allow pages to be exempt from paging mechanics of being paged out. So the user passes an IOVEC of the buffer's address and length, and on the kernel side, it'll create a BIOVEC, which is basically just an IOVEC, but for physical memory on the kernel side. Where problems start to come in, though, is the buffer register function will try to be a little bit clever and do some optimization. So there's a bit of a sidebar I have to go on here before we go further. Because when we talk about pages, typically, when you think pages, you're thinking like the block of memory, which is the minimum size that can be allocated by the kernel from physical memory. Typically, nowadays, that's going to be 4 kilobytes. But in the case of Linux, because terms just get reappropriated so much, a page can also refer to compound pages, which is basically a group of pages that are contiguous. And in compound pages, they use the first page that holds information about the group of pages comprising that compound page, and then the tail pages point back to the first page. But this insanity causes some problems, because any function that needs to operate on pages needs to know if it's a compound page, or rather if it's a tail page of a set of compound pages or just a singular page. So to solve that issue, they created this new object called a folio, or rather newer. I don't think it's like super new or anything. But yeah, it's called a folio. And that's basically just a page structure that's wrapped in this new name. And a folio type is only assigned to those first pages or singular pages. So in other words, they're never assigned to tail pages. So coming back to IOU ring, if you're trying to pin a buffer that's larger than one physical page, it will check to see if these pages are part of a compound page by checking the folio pointer. And if it is, it'll reduce the number of pages to 1 and mark it as a folio type. The problem is when they iterate over the pages and do this folio checking, they don't actually make sure the pages are physically contiguous. So you can have multiple virtual pages that map to the same physical page, which leads to the situation where the buffer is virtually contiguous, but it's not physically contiguous. They just kind of assume that it is, but they don't validate that it is. What that essentially gives you is an out-of-bounds access on adjacent physical pages. And given that these are treated as buffers and you have read and write access to them, this is stupid powerful. You can basically read and write whatever you want on these physical pages that you don't have ownership of, and just like spray some target physical pages to end up occupying that space. What they ended up targeting here was a page of socket objects, because sockets are like a pretty nice object to hit. They have a bunch of useful pointers that can allow for both kernel ASLR defeat by reading out, and then also the other nice thing with socket objects is they can tag them pretty easily. So there's some fields like the pacing rate field and one other one that I can't remember because I didn't note down, but they can just set those with a known value, and then using their read they can just check to make sure that that socket object is one of the ones that they sprayed. And then of course where you can leak the operations table pointers, it's also easy code execution because you can just replace that operations table to hijack the instruction pointer. So not only is it fairly straightforward to exploit, but because you have such a degree of control right from your initial primitive, and you can check before you're performing any corruption, this should basically be as reliable as any memory corruption can get. So as the author said, this is a stupid powerful primitive. It's not one that you see very often, but when you do see it, it's pretty cool to see, because it's not every day that you see having such fine-degreed corruption over physical pages. So
it is a very nice primitive to land in, or to land
with. Yeah, I'm jealous of this primitive. Like, it's kind of the dream primitive, basically. So yeah, the post goes into quite a bit of the background and digging into getting those physical pages set up and whatnot. And I would recommend it as a read. It's very easy to follow and go through. But yeah, even though it is an IOU ring, and a lot of the IOU ring bugs that we cover have sort of a similar exploitation strategy, because like IOU ring has a lot of primitives in and of itself, but where this bug is so unique, the exploitation strategy, while it's simple, it's brilliant as well. Sorry, Z, were you going to bring something up there? I just saw you open a tab, so...
Oh, I was just adding the link to Tobias Hull into the show notes by opening that.
Ah, okay, cool. Alright, so pretty nice segue into the next topic is we also have a topic on mitigating Linux memory corruption issues. So this was posted by Sam4K, and it talks about a newer mitigation that was added in Linux 6.6 being random kmalloc caches. So a lot of the post goes into explaining where we are with like the current heap exploitation meta and whatnot. I'm mostly going to skip over that. And what's relevant?
Skip over that. I do actually want to say it's a really good write up over those issues. I think he actually mentions in here that he meant to just be a quick overview, but actually ended up being fairly in depth with it. I forget who it was that I linked this off to. Say we're asking about something heap grooming and stuff on the Linux kernel, but it's actually a pretty decent resource along with some of his other blog posts.
Yeah. So about halfway through, it gets to actually talking about this newer mitigation. So with the kmalloc caches in Linux, you have like the size slabs, right? So you have the kmalloc 32 cache, kmalloc 64, etc. And it makes exploitation somewhat straightforward. You know, if you have a vulnerable object in that cache, like let's say an out-of-bounds write in that cache or a use after free or whatever, your target object also has to be in that cache. But if yeah, it is, like you just have to spray enough to get the layout that you want. Like you can just spray with not a lot of effort to be able to get that to happen in many cases. Sorry, go ahead, Z.
I was just going to clarify, I feel like a lot of people here are probably familiar with the caches, but if you're not, like kmalloc 32 is just like every block in there is 32 bytes, kmalloc 64, every block 64 bytes. And when you make an allocation in the kernel, it just kind of buckets you into one of those rather than giving you custom size blocks. That's what the caches are. feel like a lot of people would have been familiar with that, but at the same time, if you've mostly done user line, you might not be familiar with that idea.
Yeah, fair shout. So, yeah, I mean, for a while, it's been really straightforward. But what this random k-malloc caches mitigation does is it'll basically split the sized caches into multiple caches. So instead of just having one k-malloc 64 caches, you'll have by default 16 k-malloc 64 caches. And when you go to allocate from that cache, it can go into any one of those randomly. The seed is randomized at boot time. So it basically aims to hit the reliability of heap spraying, making it so that, you know, when you spray these allocations, it could end up in any of these different buckets where your vulnerable object is in one particular bucket. So it's just trying to hit on the reliability. It's sort of similar to what Apple did with k-malloc type, but they had a lot more. They had it where it can go into like one of like 512 different areas or whatever. So it's sort of aiming to accomplish the same sort of goal. So it's pretty straightforward in how it works. How effective it is questionable. I feel like, especially with only 16 different caches, I feel like you could probably get over this pretty easily by just spraying more, just apply more pressure and increase your chances of ending up in one of those caches. Like, it would still hit reliability, but in cases where you can spray a lot of objects, I don't think this is going to do a ton. So perhaps, and then another weakness of it. Okay, go ahead.
On that point, like, a lot of subsystems kind of have these wrappers around the allocations. Like, where this object is pretty much always allocated by the one specific location. And the way it's bucketing everything is by using that call site to say it's coming from this call site. Therefore, there's also a kernel, a boot time thing set, but it uses that plus the call site to bucket these into the different random cache. So
fair enough.
Yeah, you can't just spray the same object necessarily unless they also have different call sites. Because if you're using something like, I don't know, some of the allocations in... Actually, I think since we were talking about sockets earlier, I feel like the SK stuff tends to have a lot of wrappers around the allocations. More, I think Binder kind of has the wrappers there where, like, if you want this type of object, it only has really one allocation site. And so if it doesn't land in the right cache, you are kind of going to be screwed if you want that object. My thought was, like, this might be a place where you then need to kind of tailor the exploit a bit more. Check what, or like, have some way of checking. So it would need an extra, it would need at least an extra primitive to be able to check if your corruption landed or something like that in order to determine if it's in the same heap or in the same cache, sorry. But it could mean like having that sort of stage in exploit where you're looking at what objects are available to you and try to determine that in some way. That would be adding a significant extra step into an exploit, because you would then also need to write it in such a way that you can do the corruption against multiple types of objects, which may or may not actually be possible given your corruption, and you may not be able to actually detect that again given your initial corruption. But yeah, I did want to call it the call site aspect, because that is definitely a limiting factor in a lot of cases. You can't just spam the allocation because it's not separating them with like a normal distribution across all the caches.
Yeah, so that's my bad. I did kind of miss out on that part. I'd seen the part with the seed setup, but yeah, that seed setup is used to determine which cache a call site ends up at. It's not per allocation, it's per call site. That is a pretty important thing that does make this stronger than I had initially given a credit for.
Yeah, and it's based on the return. So, like, when something's calling into malloc, they capture the return IP, and that is the value that is used as, like, the call site. So, technically, it's after the call site, but, you know, same diff.
Yeah. One thing they do call out, though, that is a weakness still, is cross cache attacks, which you had kind of hinted at earlier. So yeah, as Z had kind of mentioned in an earlier topic, the idea with cross cache attacks is you basically manipulate the page allocator into freeing a given page that was backing one cache and get it to back a different cache. So because these caches are going to be implemented on top of pages, it's susceptible to that, right? That there's nothing stopping the page allocator from just giving it a different cache unless like some of the mitigations are enabled for that. So you could end up freeing a page that's used for like a kmalloc, one of the random kmalloc 64 caches, and get that reallocated to, you know, either a different kmalloc, one of the other random kmalloc 64 caches, or some other size. And it could still be susceptible to that. That said, the reliability impact would still be there, I think. Yeah, I mean, as is always the case with these kinds of mitigations, it's not going to be a catch-all, it's not going to stop everything. But it might be significant in hitting reliability, or at least forcing exploit developers into crafting their scenarios better, kind of like what you'd said earlier.
Yeah, like, it's definitely an interesting mitigation. It is kind of nice because, and I say nice from the security perspective, because it is relatively lightweight. Like, the method that they're using here is effectively just like a couple multiplication and a shift in order to bucket everything. Like, it's not a huge overhead. It's not a huge overhead. It's not a massive impact, but it does feel like it will definitely have an impact. Like I said, especially just around the complexity, it makes the exploit more difficult to develop because you need to deal with this in whatever way you choose to deal with it. At least when you have a vulnerability that falls into this sort of attack.
Yeah. So I'm curious to see how much it'll be used or how quickly it will be. Because one thing I will say, like, this is coming in Linux 6.6. It's pretty much unheard of for many significant applications or servers to be leveraging the bleeding edge Linux version. So it'll be a while before we'll see things catch up to be able to even use this. But when they do, like you said, where it's lightweight, it doesn't seem like it has a ton of overhead. I think it would be a fair thing to enable, especially on the more hardened, you know, kernel forks or kernel configuration options. So.
Yeah, and I didn't look at... Because
getting some use eventually.
I didn't take a look at whether or not this was actually, like, defaulting to on. Okay, it does default to off, unsurprisingly. Because it does have a performance impact. I imagine, like, Linus would not be happy to have that as a default. So, yeah, I guess we'll see who actually decides to adopt it, but...
Yeah. All right, so before we end off the show, we do have a few shout-outs. So yeah, one of them is the Thinkscapes Q3 release. I'll let Z get into this one, and yeah, then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, Thinkscapes, we've mentioned them before. They put out this quarterly research roundup, literally just in the last quarter, any research that they think is noteworthy and worth checking out. They mentioned we highlight 16 talks from, you know, various, I guess, budding trends. I thought they were going to get into how many conferences they looked at as I was reading that, but they have 16 options in there. It is a PDF that you have to download. Well, I guess they also have an EPUB, but yeah, I mean, usually they pull out and point out some good research. It's quarterly, but definitely worth checking out. I glanced at it so far, had several conference talks that actually looked pretty interesting, so I'll probably go back to it and actually watch some of them in the future. But yeah, they put it out, so I want to call it out. I haven't actually listened to their episode, but they do have what looks like a, you know, 25 minute roundup here on them. If I remember from the last Thinkscapes, they just talked about some of the research they were calling out. It wasn't a lot of like novel insight or anything from it, just calling out maybe a bit on why. But oh, it's been a little while, so maybe I'm misremembering or maybe they changed something, but that's there too. And then, yeah, we have one other shout out, which is a cache war bug, a software fault attack. This time, we've talked about a lot that we're hitting on Intel, but this one is against AMD SEVES, which I forget what SEV stands for, but this is like your secure VM, your encrypted memory.
That's It's secure encrypted virtualization.
Okay, there we go. So I kind of had the right idea there, yeah. But allows basically hijacking or control flow breaks into those encrypted VMs from the host machine, I believe, and but allows, you know, in this case, like when you're using an encrypted VM like that, you're, of course, the page literally has what it stands for just a little bit lower down, but when you're using that, you don't trust the host anymore, so the host being able to violate this starts to matter.
Yeah, so the whole idea with SCDES and SCDSMP, just to expand on them, so ES is encrypted state, SMP is secure nested pages. So, secure nested paging. So the whole idea with that is, the guest VMs have an encrypted state, so their register state and everything is encrypted. Even if the hypervisor is compromised, that guest state is protected by a key that's enforced by the secure processor. So, it's trying to do like guest isolation and whatnot. But how this cache warp stuff works is it's taking advantage of the invalid instructions, so like the invalidate cache, and it's abusing like some quirks there. I don't want to get into it too much here. Like, it is a shout out. The paper is there if you want to read it. But it's abusing that to break the cache and, as they say, potentially hijack control flow inside of encrypted VMs. So the impact is pretty high there, and sort of similar to what I was saying with the Reptar bug. It is sort of similar to fault injection situations, and you're able to induce it from software, and especially in like cloud environments where SCD is being used, that's significant. So definitely wanted to give it a shout out.
So out of chat, Sarsec mentions that cache attacks really seem to be the thing for now. And I'll be honest, I did not read this post. Like, just looking at it, I feel like it is kind of lower level than what I'm really comfortable with. So that's why I just had it as a shout out. That said, I do feel like this is going to be a bit different than like the cache attacks that we've talked about in the past, where it's dealing with like getting things evicted from cache and the side channels around, or like the different caching side channels. Like, I don't think that's what's going on here, because they talk about being able to restore a prior state, so that almost sounds like it could even be in part a crypto issue. But like I said, I did not go into all of the reading of this, so I don't want to make a claim. It does seem at least different from what we've covered a little bit in the past. Although, again, it's coming out of university and academic work, so yeah.
Yeah, I just want to point out, so reading the paper a little bit, it is a memory incoherency issue. So they're basically able to cause an incoherent view of memory between the cache and memory. And that's where the NVD instruction comes into play there. So it's a little bit different from, like you said, the cache side channel type issues, but sort of adjacent to it as well. It's not too far away from it.
Yeah. But might be all right. Interesting. I mean, especially being that security area.
Yeah. So that's all the topics we have for today. So as always, thanks goes out to all of you for listening. If you want to go back and check out past episodes, you can find them on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more links off of Anchor. It's worth noting that we are thinking of switching up the podcast format a little bit for the new year. So if you have some thoughts on us going to a record-only format, or at least doing streams but not on a set schedule, we would love to hear some feedback on that. So feel free to leave that in our Discord or on Twitter, wherever we are. Discord and Twitter links are down below or in the chat. And with that said, we'll see you next week.